Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining us here in the Members Hour. We are having a fascinating conversation with Ross Hamilton, Jim Vieira, and Hugh Newman. And I want to begin to talk about the usage of some of these ancient sites and what the... Well, there seems to be an obsession with stoneworks, of course, both standing stones and stones in different configurations. Then on top of that, we have the mounds, which also seems to be a similar thing, but also a very distinctly different thing. And I wanted to begin with you, Jim, and see if there's anything you want to say about this and what you see. We can begin with the usages of the mounds, I guess. Tell us about that.
You know, my thought is that they are multi-use creations, whether stone or earth, that they act as tools of enlightenment to help the initiate tap into higher levels of consciousness or a multidimensional reality, but also practical uses like the crop production and the harvesting of energy, you know, like the way an acupuncturist would put needles in your body, you put standing stones in the ground. And, I really just believe that there is acupuncture meridians throughout the earth, essentially, and you harvest this energy. And I feel like the sites now call people back to that way of life, a higher level of connection and cooperation. You know, we really have created, we dug ourselves quite a hole. Our cultures, I mean, I watched like a quarter of the Super Bowl and I wanted to hang myself. I just couldn't believe it. I don't have a TV and I'm like, you know, it is so, so disconcerting and unsatisfying what our culture offers us. There is, no level of connection. The system wants compliant consumers and wants to destroy indigenous cultures around the world and evidence that people can work together for the greater good. And I can see that, you know, when I speak to professionals, it's like they had the spirit of magic killed in them. Yeah. You know, they no longer think outside the box and are tapping into a multidimensional reality or the reality of what they truly are. So I feel like compelled. This isn't just like, oh, that's interesting to me. This is like, it's time to reawaken to like the spirit of magic and doing what you love in life and inspiring people. And I feel like these structures imbue that wisdom in people electromagnetically. And when you visit them, I know Ross and you have been all around these structures also. It raises your vibrational charge essentially and allows you the courage to speak like we are speaking and talk about things that are considered esoteric or marginalized as crazy. They're just not true. My intuition and my experience is that basically every utterance over the last couple of hours is correct. So that's the way I would categorize it.
Very good. To you, Jim, does any of this have to do with graves? I mean, are there clear examples where, again, the mounds specifically are used as tombs? Or do we have that interesting situation where a people at a later time is moving into an area, let's say, where there are standing stones or mounds or other things, and that's where they bury their dead? How do you kind of sort this out, if you will?
Yeah. Intrusive burials seem to have happened all around the globe, actually. I just think, like Ross said, there was a high and mighty civilization, just like the Freemasons and the Rosicrucians and Edgar Casey talk about, that looted the planet after a cataclysm over 10,000 years ago. They built structures of, you know, astounding sophistication. And the ancestors of those people understood the sites were sacred, and they would congregate there and they would use them and sometimes abuse them, like you have with the Aztecs, kind of turning away from the spirit of the creator and creating human sacrifice and doing all kinds of acts like that. But, you know, for the most part, you have an understanding that there is a higher level of multidimensionality that exists that you can tap into, and you can use things to get there. You know, one thing I'll say is that I know the native races of the United States never separated the mundane from the sacred. So if they built a stone chamber to house beaver pelts, they're going to use quartzite boulders in it, and they're going to align it to the equinox or this the winter solstice, for instance. So you have that weaving of everything together as sacred, which we clearly set, you know, we have our Walmarts and we have our churches, but they're not the same, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Now, I wanted to ask all of you, and we can begin with you, Jim, if there are any potential areas where there could be new exciting finds, places or locations where you'd like to see digs, or basically where you suspect that if they would to look closer at the area, there would be, you know, amazing discoveries found there. What do you think, Jim?
I think Turkey on land is an area that I would like to see technology brought to bear. And I think around Egypt, still around the Great Pyramids, there's a lot to be revealed and that may have been found also and cordoned off. I'm sure Hugh could speak to that. But I'm with Graham Hancock, frankly. I think the coastlines underwater around the world, you have Yonaguni, you have many sunken cities. Greg Little, for instance, talks about mounds off the coast of, I believe, South Carolina that are underwater that I believe a lot of these sites got inundated by sea level rise over 10,000 years ago, like Graham Hancock talks about. And it is underappreciated and under investigated. I think all around the world we have sites that are underneath the ocean. Just like Paulina Zelitsky, I think it was 2001, with side scan radar, people pretty familiar with the underwater structures off of Cuba. You know, why isn't there a follow-up with things like that? Or a concerted effort, you know, to investigate these things. All the funneling of funds and grants go in a particular direction. That's just to keep the status quo.
Yeah.
A logical person would say, let's spend $500 billion on a archaeological project around the world and get governments together. Let's spend $700 billion to find alternative resources or investigate Nikola Tesla's claims and that were confiscated by the government. I'll quickly say a quick litmus test of a society is if I told you I have an electromedical device that cures AIDS and cancer and all kinds of diseases and is relatively cheap, and if I told you I had a pellet you could put in your gas tank to give you 700 miles to the gallon, would I be hailed as a hero or gunned down in the street?
Yeah.
You know, so you really, you know, people have this hard time believing that this poisonous, you know, attitude has infected academia. Well, it has, and it's the focal point for misinformation. That's my rant.
Very good. Now, I mean, what you bring up there is very important as well. This is our origins at stake here. What has happened on the planet previously? This is anthropology. This is study of mankind, where we come from, and everything else. And the lack of investigation, Jim, here is well suspicious, I would say, nothing else. Because I mean, certainly there are money out there. There are, you know, grants to the left and right, and you know, scientific investigations in all kinds of areas. But this one is left alone, practically left alone, and it's up to people like yourselves and Ross and Hugh and others to do this, you know, with their own means and what they have, you know, at their disposal, basically.
Yes, absolutely. I've made about minus 10 grand so far. So I just do it on my own dime because I feel compelled to do it, and I know it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, indeed. Ross, let me switch over to you, and I wanted to ask you the same question that I asked Jim earlier about if there are any locations or places where you'd like to see digs, or where you think there could be incredible, you know, archaeological discoveries. What do you think?
Well, I had a speciality in the Ohio Valley, and I've used a kind of a development of my energies, my visionary energies, to explore the region here. And I found that here, like in other places around the planet, there are repositories that have been very carefully constructed that have the necessary accoutrements, if you will, to help us rebuild many of these temples. Artifacts that we'd have difficulty redeveloping technologically that have been carefully stored in various repositories for the right time. Now, I think Jim is more to the point, though, because we're not that close to opening up any of the repositories. But in the meantime, we're going to be doing something called peeling back layers. Hugh was kind enough to let me in on a find in Glastonbury. Now, those of you who aren't familiar with the Glastonbury Zodiac, as they call it, it's a depiction of a number of mythological creatures and people spread out over 50, 60, 70 square miles that seem to basically surround a single point, which may be the Glastonbury Tor, where they could have received their lightning strikes and energized the whole picture at one time. But the Zodiac was first revealed back in the early part of the last century by a lovely woman. She has since passed on, but many people have investigated her work. And just recently, someone discovered a unicorn. And he showed it to me, and it was quite obviously there the whole time. But for some reason, not enough light was cast on the big map, the big picture of Glastonbury. In other words, not enough understanding, not enough people kind of sharing the consciousness of Glastonbury was present to be able to see that the Zodiac actually is larger. And this unicorn is a perfect horse. Hasn't really been made that popular yet, but eventually it will become probably a part of the lore. So similarly, when we look over, you know, out from the coast of India in the Indian Ocean, we're starting to discover these ancient temple structures, and some of them are quite deep, which means that there's been quite an inundation of water occurred, which means that there was a major meltdown at one time. So the question is, yes, well, were there many islands that were submerged in the Atlantic Basin and Pacific Basin? Yeah, likely there were. And the people that lived on these islands may have had higher technologies, but that when these islands became inundated, many of them left and formed colonies in Greece, Egypt, up around, you know, in Denmark, Sweden, in Germany, in England, throughout Europe, and of course in the Americas. And many of these colonies embodied the basic understanding of the technology that was in use in those days in order to harness the magnetic field. So Egypt, Greece, the Americas flourished up until about 5,000-6,000 years ago, when the lights were definitely taken out. Now, the other point I wanted to make was that when we look at these sites today, we can see that there is some wisdom in even the ruins of them. And a lot of that wisdom has to do with trapping the magnetic energy of the Earth in a certain way so that it can be utilized for the benefit of people. And in the Serpent Mound and in the earthworks of the Ohio Valley, for example, there's a very careful construction using a Reichian, or in other words, an Oregonian type of layering, where you have, an area of land that receives a great deal of energy, like Serpent Mound, because it's in a highly faulted area that pulls energy up from deep in the earth, polarizes it, and then the effigy was built so that the energy was transferred first into a rock base, and then into a particular type of clay, and then another type of clay, because this energy, in order to become like a serpent power, has to transform itself through moving through different types of matter in order to achieve a certain consciousness on its own. And this is the beginning of the serpent power. The serpent power is a quasi-intelligent force that was created by ancient man in order to focus at different spots, and these were called serpent layers or dragon layers. And so this spiritual technology began with a rock base, which is what Jim is investigating, and then the creation of caves, artificial caverns, produced an ethereal environment, because when you charge up a rock cave. And Jim, I think this is why there's a lot of those root cellars in New England. When you are able to charge up a cave like that, the energy works like in a nuclear fashion. You know, like they created the first nuclear bomb to have a core of radioactive material, but to be crushed from all different directions simultaneously. And this is what occurs only in the reverse, in a peaceful way, in these stone caverns that were artificially created. A great deal of the charged etheric energy was placed in there. And so people could store things in there and they would be charged up. Also, when these caves filled up, they would pulse and send out this wonderful energy along these long lines of stones or through the countryside to be picked up by the next standing stone on a straight path. And ultimately, these collection systems were the mark of a very highly intelligent but slightly devolved focus on what the Atlanteans and Lemurians understood in a very highly refined and technologically sophisticated way. One of the things they possessed that's coming back to us subconsciously through our karma that we see embodied in the New Agers is the possession of crystals. Everybody loves crystals, and everybody loves pyramids, you know, and we have little pyramids. Sometimes they're made with crystals. And this was actually a very serious part of the technology in the old days, because having a crystal at the apex of a pyramid would highly refine the natural magnetic energy of the earth up to a point where the energy would become almost polarized and sort of quasi-intelligent. And then after it passed through the highest layer, which would be gold or some highly conductive material like out of limestone, then it would pass into the crystal like a diamond or something, which would be made in the image of the pyramid or the effigy, like a Serpent Mound had one. And then it would pass into the atmosphere, and the atmosphere would be enthralled by it because it would be like a very intelligent woman calling some, you know, sky god to make love with her. And he would send down his spermatic charge. And when the two of them combined, he would conform to her intelligences, of course. He was the boss. When the two energies combined, they would then travel back down the casing stones of the pyramid, inundate the land, and then you could grow corn right out of the sand, because the etheric energy would permeate the sand, and it has this sort of ability to conform to the needs of any seed. And so all you would need would be water. And so people could grow things right out of the desert.
Let me ask you this. In those days. I don't mean to cut you off, Ross, but this is a very interesting point. I want to ask you more about this because I was thinking as you're talking about this, what the reason potentially was for them to try to develop or tap into this energy. If there is a cyclical nature that you mentioned before to the comings and goings, if you will, of this energy, then maybe this is at a time when this natural property is kind of dissipating, if you will. So they understand that they need to do something extra to kind of preserve it. So ultimately, is this about agriculture, survival, to get food, etc.? Because again, what is the reason for why they needed this to begin with, do you think?
Okay, that's really great, Henrik. I'm glad that you're the moderator. At Serpent Mound, we had a couple of scientists come in the mid-90s, Burke and Hal Burke. One of them has passed away now, I think, Burke. And they published a book called Seed of Knowledge, Stone of Plenty. And in it, they documented their visiting many different sacred sites throughout the UK and the United States. And on the Serpent Mound, they left bags of various kinds of seeds. And then they took control samples, and then they take the control and the seeds that have been left on the earthwork to this lab in Michigan, and they had them tested for growth. And what they found was that the seeds that have been left on Serpent Mound compared to the control seeds from the same, you know, origin were more disease resistant, had a greater hatch rate, almost 100%, and they grew 5 to 6 times faster and larger than the control seeds. So apparently the ancients understood that by creating these temple-like structures, or by refurbishing these foundations from older temples and using this alternating layers of material to enhance the intelligence of the naturally occurring energy, they were able to translate or transfer that energy into the energetic germ or the spirit of the seed, which is located in the nib of the seed, where the germ is, the point where the seed germinates and sends out its root, so that the spirit was able to communicate or commune with a spirit that was its like, only in great abundance, and therefore grew emboldened and grew to be like a master elemental spirit in each one of these seeds. And as a result of that, those seeds were able to display their full genetic properties. So in the future, we can look to not experimenting with the changing of genetics or GMOs, but we can look to enhancing the seeds of things through rehabilitating seeds by enlivening their natural spirit.
Ah, fascinating. Jim, anything to add to that? Have you come to the similar conclusions in your work?
I've read the book that Ross is talking about. Yeah, my conclusion is there is a spiritual technology that we're going to quickly have to rediscover to kind of shift where we're at as a society. And I just believe, you know, some people may hear this and like, oh, that's a utopian ideal or whatever, but I think it's going to, these ideas are going to continue to spread very rapidly. And we're going to have to work together with open-minded scientists and figure out, you know, how we can imbue the energy that Ross is talking about in all our efforts in life, and just create sustainable models and use a higher intelligence to get the job done. And so I really, you know, what he's saying resonates with me. And I know, you know, it's not like a lot of the people who are on this path of trying to bring suppressed information to the masses. It's not about, oh, this guy's a great detective and he's going to, you know, produce this case. It's a desire for a different kind of life, I think, that we all feel. Like, you know, if I said, oh, I'm going out to Arizona next week and I'm going to stay at a farm there and help out for 3 months and travel and then come back to the Northeast, and, you know, these ideas, instead of, no, I got to work my 60-hour week job, and when I'm done, I got to pick up my 20-hour part-time job just to stay above water. You know, this with technological advances, you know, it's so difficult the way things are currently constituted, and the siphoning off of wealth to the highest 1%. There is something desperately wrong with the way our society is put together. And I think people are awakening to that. But you just can't rail against the system. You need to create possibilities and ways to work together creatively and to be imbued with a particular energetic state. So I built stone structures. I built stone towers of 13 feet high. I'm going to build a 20-foot stone tower this summer. And I view it as a transducer of energy to kind of imbue the landscape with a higher form of energy. And I agree with all of what Ross and you say, and I think we're on the same page.
There seems to be no time left over for, well, reality, basically. People are living in a bubble, and it seems to be, in some cases, voluntarily as well. I mean, there are always options, but people seem to chase, if you will, the dreams of what others have told them to chase. And this is what you're talking about, Jim, is something different. It's about trying to reconnect with what is real on the planet, the full experience of being human, of course. And that's why this is a subject that have many different tangents into other areas, into other points. So I definitely agree with you. But do you think that there is something, I don't know, maybe this is too dramatic, but shutting down, as I said before, if this is an energy that kind of is dissipating, as Ross suggested, is there therefore a need for us to even more now try to tap into that once again? Because those other systems, maybe natural systems or properties of the planet or the energy grid, what have you, is kind of, I don't know, shutting down or slowly just trickling out. What do you think, Jim?
I think absolutely. I think there's a movement around the planet to wake up to this reality, but there has to be some active participation in like reawakening the grid of the planet. You know, just by visiting particular sites with an open mind, it energizes what is, you know, the, you could call the acupuncture meridians of the planet or the energetic pathways. And, you know, I see actual collaborative engineering projects in the future where people get together and build certain structures in a way that everybody works together cooperatively to harness, you know, the energies of the ether. And I really feel it's extremely important, and I can see it, I can envision it being done. But the systems of control are unraveling right now, and it looks like they have more control than ever. You know, there's National Defense Authorization Act and the Patriot Act and the Vatican and everything that's going on, you see. But
sure.
I feel it's the death throes of the, it's the last waltz of the tyrants. And, but something, you know, when it all burns to the ground and the system of fiat currency and everything else goes up in smoke, people are going to look for answers. And that's why I think a lot of people are grassroots wise, just creating sustainable models. You know, I'll go out with 15 to 20 people. We'll take hikes in the woods and we'll stop and we'll meditate and we'll have a good time. And we'll just try to imbue it with an experience, an energetic experience that resonates into your life, that helps unravel and, you know, wake you up from the matrix and the zombie-like compliant consumer culture that we live in. So I feel like it's a communal effort. And I really think the more people can just hook into this new energy, I think it will help transform the world.
Hugh, do you also see this science being reawakened, I guess? And I'd be curious to know how you think it might be, I guess, beneficial as well to mankind or us just individually. What do you think, Hugh?
Well, I think there's, I think there's been recently a re-enchantment of the landscape. This is something that John Michel kind of pointed out repeatedly in all his works and his talks and his books, that in ancient times, the ancients, I believe, would enchant the landscape, not just by building one site, but linking many sites up, you know, into what, you know, what we can call grids or lays or alignments or whatever you, whichever way you want to approach it. And I think we've lost that. We don't have that anymore. If we backtrack to what Ross was saying about the Glastonbury Zodiac and the Star Mounds book and project he's working on in Ohio, we have to realize that the ancients were working on a vast scale, and they were encoding knowledge and wisdom and harmony into the landscape itself. So even people living in it didn't even know that it was even there. It just, yeah. You know, you couldn't even tell. And so I think that was an important part of the ancient system of maintaining harmony, a higher state of consciousness, and a certain level of sophistication and compassion on the planet. And I think these gods or these giants or whatever you want to call them were instrumental in that. And now the way we construct and we build, cities and housing estates, this isn't considered. And this is just like, this is anti-geomancy is what I call it. And whereas we need to go back to this geomantic way of approaching working with the landscape, because we are the landscape. We're connected with it. We are the same. We're made of it. We're the same thing. We're part of the same Earth system, the same Gaia system. And we're out of harmony with it. And now geomancers, the main work they do, and I know many of them, I work with many of them, are just out there trying to fix the problems that modern society has overlaid, you know, with roads and cities that aren't thought about. It's all about profit. And so I think, you know, reinvestigating the way the ancients operated could be a guidebook for the way we need to operate. And so as we discover what the ancients were up to, you know, with how they constructed the secret geometry and the maths and the numbers and the harmony that they were using, we're coming back round to that higher level of consciousness that the ancients were obviously at. So it's a bit convoluted, but I think, you know, we have to, by studying the ancients, we can move into a level of consciousness that they were at, which there are relations, there are relatives, there are bloodlines, we're all the same. But we are, as Jim pointed out, we are being dragged down through watching the Super Bowl and too much television and society and media. And there's a great opportunity. I feel like a spell has been broken. With this is why this information is now coming out, this Masonic information, the information encoded in the megaliths, the grids, and obviously the giants. We're really reconnecting to a part of ourselves which has been closed off. So it's an exciting time to be researching these subjects.
Indeed. Ross, I wanted to ask you more about the ancient sites of Ohio specifically, since you're up there, and maybe we can begin to talk more about the Serpent Mound specifically. I mean, it's a magnificent site. It's just probably one of the most impressive, as far as I know, in North America. What is it all about, do you think?
I've been studying Serpent Mound for 25 years, actually 27 years now. And I gradually worked myself up to the point where they've given me a seat of teaching there on the weekends or during the week, anytime I want to go up and sit down and teach. They allow it. The reason is because I think I have a sort of fate or a karma, if you will, to help to propagate this this information that we're hopefully going to be able to sum up pretty well by the end of this program. And in the case of Serpent Mound, I think we have one of the premier sacred sites, at least through deciphering its codes, in the world. And the reason I say this is because it has what appears to be a pyramid. It has what appears to be an accumulation, a system of orgone accumulation, if you will, vitality accumulation. It also has a complete array of astronomical alignments, including all of the solstice events, the two equinoxes and the two summer solstices, rising and setting. And it has an account of the entire lunar cycle, at least half of the 18.6-year lunar cycle, encoded in its seven coils perfectly, beautifully. It resonates with Stonehenge in that if you placed a model of Stonehenge, actual size, to the west of the coils of the serpent, within the folds of the serpent coils, which you can see in my book, you'll see that all of the astronomical alignments converge in that area of Stonehenge. So it also has a resonation with the constellation Draconis from overhead. So we have a knowledge of astronomy that surpasses anything known anywhere else in the world to date. It has a complete and final knowledge of astronomy encoded in its coils and head. What makes it doubly more interesting, perhaps, and we discussed this at the last Megalithomania conference in the United States, which he was gracious enough to let me be on, is the fact that the serpent also entertains, like it was a template, all of the classical geometric forms, including one of the early of the Pythagorean solids. And these include the circle, of course, the square, the Pythagorean theorem, and also the sacred hexagon, as mentioned in the Book of Revelation, or has been popularized by Druvalo as the flower of life. It contains, out of the flower of life hexagon, the Vesica Pisces also. And all of these aren't just sort of inferential and hidden, but they're classical examples that the serpent seems to illuminate once they're placed together with it. So if that's not astonishing enough, the serpent also seems to encode in it through its geometrics and its lights, its celestial lights falling upon it, knowledge of alchemy, real alchemy that explains to us the serpent's possible purpose on the landscape, that is, to conferiate or bring together, as in a marriage, the twin principles of earth and sky to produce the philosopher's stone, or in other words, the highest expression of love that nature can produce. The sort of golden ratio in the form of an energy that spread out at some time, at some point in prehistory, from Serpent Mound when it was built up with all of its software and hardware, and you know, pulling the energy up from the from deep in the earth and resonating with the sky out to all of the precincts of the Ohio Valley, hundreds and hundreds of square miles all around, knew the resonance of this wonderful Manitou in the shape of a great serpent that seemed to pull together all the miniature little serpent energies and intelligences of the landscape. And at the head of it, according to Indian legend, was this wonderful jewel that they call the Ulanyasut, which we think means the dust of heaven. And it was a jewel that, when it was properly lighted, put out a lampion of energy that allowed for the eyesight to be purified and for the individual to be able to see through the rays of light coming from that maximum flame embodied in that crystal, the happy hunting grounds, or the good lands, the fairy lands, the etheric world, which is directly adjacent and actually inundates our world. So when this lamp was lit, it had sympathetic lamps and a collection of jewels that the native people called the Ulanyasuti, many of which, after their removal from their Manitou structures, were kept by the medicine men for centuries, many centuries before they were lost or hidden altogether. And we think that a similar system existed at Glastonbury, where there was a many jewel-like sort of like hardwares that were placed at points on the landscape that resonated with the central structure, perhaps the tor at Glastonbury, and that they all formed a picture that had many lights that reflected the light of the stars in heaven. And when these communities, which reflected the previous communities on now lost Atlantis and Lemuria, were going full tilt, the people enjoyed an existence as truly cosmological citizens of a land that they literally walked with the gods, and they were themselves gods. But when this technology was removed, precisely when the crystals were removed from their Manitous, and we had over 60 or 70 of them in the Ohio Valley surrounding all around the Serpent Mound, then the darkness fell upon the people. And the native people talk about it. They say that about 5,000 years ago, they fell into tribal systems that separated themselves, formed different bloodlines, and actually started different races among the Indians themselves. And this apparently occurred all over the earth because we didn't have a sufficient internal spirituality developed to keep that spirit of love and brotherhood alive, so that when the technology was removed, the people who were totally dependent upon it fell also into darkness. And hence we see a gradual diminishment of the stature from being giants of spirituality and physicality into mere mortals.
Ah, interesting. Now, the Serpent Mound is located on a plateau with something that is called a crypto-explosion structure, and this is believed then to have been produced either by a meteorite or a volcanic explosion. But how do you think that this contributes to the location and form and, I guess, everything of how this all turned out, Ross?
Well, that's a good question, too. What's interesting about the location of Serpent Mound is that it's located on one, perhaps the only meteor impact zone that found, after it had ruptured the rock for several miles down, found an already existent anomaly that had already ruptured the planet many miles further down to actually touch into the mantle of the Earth itself, so that it's possible that using a demand and supply system, once the Serpent Mound got kind of reactivated, it could have demanded enough energy that could have tapped into the core of the Earth itself, which is probably so highly charged with electromagnetic energy being very close to the magnetic core, that the Serpent Mound could have been at one point in early history a very potent temple that would have been able to literally release so much stress from the mantle of the Earth that it could have been instrumental in tandem with a sun disk, which laid across the oval part of the Serpent Mound. A sun disk could have been manipulated along with the lamp at the head of the serpent to draw more energy out of the Earth and thereby reduce the possibility of stress within the plate structure in the immediate vicinity of that part of the Earth, and therefore the possibility of earthquakes. Now, if such a system were copied and made to work all over the Earth, like in the times of the antediluvian world, I think very strongly that we would be able to put earthquakes under control within less than 300-400 years to literally quiet the Earth down, and also to send feedback enough energy to the core of the Earth to reestablish that electromagnetic body and increase the energy of the magnetic field and further protect us. Now, there's an old Norse myth that says at one time the Earth was protected by a huge dragon, and that at some point the dragon folded its wings, and then we all fell into darkness.
Interesting. So this has something to do with, again, properties in space. It's conditions that existed at one point, and then they're gone. They're vanished for whatever reason. Some people connect this with a great catastrophe as well, Ross. Do you agree with that too? That there might have been, I don't know, planetary collisions or incoming bodies of some kind that kind of disrupted the natural system?
Yeah, I think that it's a complicated complicated picture. You know, I'm a bit of a catastrophist myself. I learned that from Vine Deloria too, who was a friend with Emanuel Velikovsky, by the way. And Vine and Emanuel Velikovsky really were pioneering this catastrophist ideology, where it seems that flooding, meteoric catastrophe, interplanetary collision, and a variety of other factors, including a shifting of the Earth's crust, could have contributed to the annihilation of the establishment of the spiritual technology that once held fast to a particular grid work. By the way, Hugh Newman has published a lovely little book regarding the Earth grid, and I think everybody should have a copy, although it's probably pretty hard to get, Hugh. It explains the various theories that have been put forth of a grid that could have been used in ancient times. However, the grid did appear. I think that we will at some point tap into it, and it's not that far. Some technology suggests, like at Serpent Mound, there's a point in the middle of the oval where six lines of energy converge, and if you put a crystal there, for some reason the energy begins to vibrate the crystal, and it can be recorded by any amateur camera. A friend of Hugh's and mine recorded a sound coming when he put a crystal at this convergence point. And if these points exist all over the planet, we have the ability right at our fingertips to begin to kind of rephase with the etheric body of the Earth. In other words, drawing energy out of the ethereal and recirculating it into our lower dimension, which is thirsty for that water, and thereby this grid system that Hugh outlines can be essential in the knowledge of how to begin to restore the planet as a whole. I'm sure you've heard, Henrik, how there's a general belief in the underground, you know, the movement of the young at heart, and the I would call the right brain, left wing people in the United States especially, calling it that, where we believe that the Earth is on the verge of a great transformation, and that 2012 was the year marking the beginning of that transformation, when the old order will disappear and the new order will establish itself. And we think that that new order will be earmarked or actually made available to us through understanding or comprehending the ability for us to rephase with the already extant etheric body.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. Jim, I wanted to ask you how you think, how we can explain the cultural similarities of these early cultures of giants that seem to have existed all across the world. Do you think we're talking about a slow cultural influence with simply expansion of the same culture to different parts of the world? Or was there travel and seafaring going on at that time? What do you think, Jim?
I certainly think there was a global maritime civilization over 10,000 years old. That's what all the evidence points to. And, you know, I can't claim to know exactly what was going on if, you know, there are different theories. I just feel like, you know, I'm kind of a fan of Edgar Cayce, and I believe that there was a race called Atlantis or a civilization, and they were particularly large. And they spread across the continents, and Contiki, Viracocha, Kukulcan, all the the bearded giants that showed up on the shores of South and Central America, and pyramids were named after. I think they were, you know, let me quickly say that in Egypt and in South America, there were both legends of giant bearded beings showing up after a cataclysm, outlawing cannibalism, bringing arts and societies, you know, wonders to the populace. And then you find the two pyramids on either side of the Atlantic, both built by Pi and with idiosyncratic angles of 51.8 and 43.5 at Teotihuacan on the other side of the Atlantic. So, you know, is that all an accident? Can we think that there was no cross-pollinization or a mother culture? You really can't have it both ways, you know. You just can't say that's a coincidence. And the two largest pyramids at Teotihuacan and the two largest pyramids at Giza are both built at the same elevation. And they're aligned to Orion and on and on and on. And I just think, you know, to be bogged down in the foolishness of conventional theories, it's, you know, I've moved past wasting my time, you know, dealing with people who are stuck there and cannot evaluate evidence open-mindedly. I think we're, you know, I don't theorize too much. I try to prove the case of what I'm studying, but I think it's very apparent that something else is going on. And anybody who tries to marginalize thousands of hours and decades of research in a sentence without open-mindedly evaluating the situation is not qualified to comment on it. And I encourage people to lose faith in people, professionals, institutions that refuse to view things in an open-minded fashion. You know, I don't claim to have all the answers, but the one thing I do have is an open mind. And I see, you know, people moving in that direction where they're just being more open-minded. And like I said, you know, that's the goal for me and other people, is just let's evaluate these things open-mindedly. Let's study anomalies like Einstein and Eddington studied Newton's anomaly. Eddington went to Africa to film the eclipse, and they proved that Newton was wrong and changed history by studying anomalies. Let's not be like the priests of Galileo's time and refuse to look through the telescope. Let's evaluate all evidence. And I realize, Heinrich, I'm up against a hard break. Would it be okay to sign off now?
Okay, sure, definitely. Whatever's going on there. Why don't you leave us with some of the details about how people can contact you then before we let you go there, Jim?
Excellent. I would say go to my Facebook page if you have an interest. Stone Builders, Mound Builders, and the Giants of Ancient America. And I have lengthy and numerous posts about this. And just try to review it with an open mind. I think you'll quickly see that there is something quite compelling going on. And there is a lot of evidence to back it up. It is not, like I said, I don't theorize much. I, you know, just lay out large amounts of evidence and come see for yourself. And I appreciate your time and what you do. And Ross and Hugh, we will cross paths soon. I appreciate talking to you guys. I think this is just an excellent convergence and synchronistic event that I was happy to be a part of.
Thank you, Jim. We really appreciate your time. Have a good rest of your day, and we'll carry on with Ross and Hugh for the remainder here of the hour. So thank you again, Jim.
Awesome.
All right. Well, why don't we shift over to something, actually a point that Jim brought up, and I wanted to, I can ask you about this, Hugh, and bring you back into this as well. He mentioned that there seems then to be a scenario that we have giants and quote unquote regular sized people at the same time. That there was the question that arises with that is that there might have been actually conflict between these. We did a show a little bit earlier with Josh Reeves, who did the film The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, who brought up this very interesting point that there might have been not only two different kinds of giants, but that there actually potentially were persecuted by the regular sized people, if you will, that there was a conflict here. And this is partially why they also got eradicated. Is this something you've heard, Hugh?
Yes, I have heard that. There is some evidence of that in the Middle East and sort of Hittite area. I think where Herodotus, he was actually, when he was exploring the area, there's reports written in an unusual kind of style of language where suggesting that on the battlefield there were giants next to normal-sized human skeletons. And I think there's also interesting in the Nevada caves, Lovelock, where these very tall red-haired giants existed. And they were actually fairly ferocious, and they actually became persecuted by by the little people, by the normal-sized humans. And so there's always this battle. But I think, I've read Ross's work, A Tradition of Giants, and I think he has covered, I think he may be the best person to ask this, covered a lot of the battles that did take place between different races. So maybe you want to tackle that one, Ross.
Yeah. In the United States, in the ancient United States, there was a civilization here that deteriorated from a godlike stature. And then the people scattered. The Maya, for example, claim they came from the Ohio Valley originally, and then took over Mexico and set up a semblance of their civilization. And many different groups seem to have left the area. And then, by karmic reaction, they seem to come back. And we have a testimony from the Delaware Indians, who actual name was the Lenni Lenape. That's what they call themselves in their language. And around 1000 BC, about 3000 years ago, they were moving from the western part of the United States, en masse to the eastern, because the Great Spirit told them that their promised land was there in the east. So apparently there were many thousands of them, kind of like just picture Moses and his brood of people traversing the desert, looking for the promised land. And they're moving through the prairies, and they get to the woodlands, and they come to the Mississippi River, which pretty much divides the United States in half. And it's a broad river, and so they set up a camp there, and they sent their scouts across. And when the scouts came back, they said that it was a beautiful land, but it was inhabited by a race of giants. And so they said, well, that's interesting. Maybe that's the promised land. Maybe that's the land of our ancestors. So they sent messengers over to the Allegheny people. And they asked the Allegheny if they could live among them. And the Allegheny apparently already had a sort of subservient class of smaller people living among them, and who they were breeding with and so forth. And they said, no, we don't want any more people. And they were very arrogant about it, and they didn't send any emissaries across the Mississippi to check out their people. And so the Lenape said, well, we're sorry to hear that. Can we cut through your land to lands further, if they exist? And they said, yes, you may do that. Because the Allegheny lived in the Ohio Valley and up into Michigan and the Great Lakes. And some say parts of the Deep South. But they didn't live on the East Coast, which was rather sparsely inhabited 3,000 years ago. So the Lenape got all their people up and all their animals, And they started to wade across the Mississippi. And just imagine, you know, Moses crossing the Red Sea. And they get over, a number of them get over. And the Allegheny look at them and they see, my God, there's thousands of them. So they thought they had been deceived and that it was a Trojan horse. So the Allegheny set upon these people, according to the story given to us by the native people, and they kill as many as they can. Well, this greatly upset the Lenni Lenape, and they had the holy bejesus scared out of them, so to speak. So they ran back across the river. And at that time, another tribe came down from the north who were friendly, and they talked to them about these giants who were very protective of their lands. And they asked them, if we make war against them for taking advantage of us like that, will you back us up? And the Mengwe people, and that was their name, said yes. So according to the legend, it took them 100 years, but they used a guerrilla warfare tactic because the Allegheny people, who were once a mighty nation of gods and highly evolved giant people, had diminished themselves to the point of being comprised of a number of city-states, like the Greeks had degenerated to. And the city-states would not help the others, similar to what the Greeks did. And therefore, the Lenape with the Mengwe were able to take advantage of this and gradually defeat, over 100 years, these Allegheny people. But during that time, they captured many of their women and some of their men and inbreeded with them, and they produced a hybrid race that we call the Yadena people. And therefore, there have been wars in the United States. And in fact, the Yadena people later were considered to be frightening because many of them had giants among them, the genetics of which they inherited from the Allegheny. So ultimately and eventually, these giants spread out to the north, to the east, to the south, and to the west. And therefore, many of the tribal structures, including those that Jim was citing, and those of the Osage and the Western Plateau, and throughout the Great South, up into Michigan and Pennsylvania, embodied at the core of their political systems, men of gigantic stature. Now, this doesn't address the very large giants that were found in California, but we believe that they were part of that early Alligui family that migrated outward when the lamps were taken off of the temple structures here in the United States.
I wanted to ask you briefly, Ross, as well about Poverty Point in Louisiana, if you've been there, or if you have any thoughts on what that might be.
Yeah, Poverty Point appears to be part of a superstructure that was reconstructed in a very short time, by the way, from an earlier site that was perhaps at least 5,000-6,000 years old, and that there was once a great country that existed, and Poverty Point was at the lowest part of that country, near the Gulf of Mexico. And that this country was recorded by the Smithsonian early on through one of their early ethnologists, J.W. Powell, who lived with Indian people, and said there were seven great cities. And they went from Sault Ste. Marie down to where Lansing is, down to where Cincinnati is, then to Lexington, and then into Tennessee, into Atlanta, and then finally into Florida, which is a Tallahassee area. And that these areas, along with Poverty Point and a few others, have great antiquity as sacred areas, but were just constructs of these wonderful mythological cities that were reproduced from an Atlantean empire long before. Now, the Allegheny people, when they first began to deteriorate, maintained their roots of trade. And I think that Poverty Point, among other sites in Florida and the Gulf, were still used as departure and reception points for trade that was being carried on with copper and other metals. And also they were held to be very good at ceramics that were being, exchanged overseas and throughout Central and South America. And eventually Poverty Point fell into disuse as the people fell into greater and greater darkness.
Yeah, it seems to be the same kind of story with a lot of these different sites, that they've fell into disuse, they've been covered up by natural, the elements of soil, and maybe through tsunamis and everything else, catastrophe that has happened. And then at other points, later civilizations have moved into these areas and started living there. And although they don't claim to have built them, they've become to become representatives of, those very structures. It seems to go back way, way, way back, which is, very, very interesting in itself. We are going to begin to wrap up here in a few minutes or so. It's been a very interesting conversation. And of course, this will carry on as with so many other topics, and there's so much to add to it, of course. I want to ask you, Hugh, if there's anything else you want to add on to this, or something you feel that would be pertinent to kind of connect with all of this.
Well, I just think this is, I've kind of had my mind slightly blown by some of Ross's and Jim's comments and research. And I just get a sense that, it's up to people, like this is like what Jim and Ross have been doing for years. It's really up to the listeners to go to their local record offices and find early reports and ask the museums to look in their basement for artifacts and extremely large bones and things like this, because this is how we find things out. People don't realize that a lot of the research and discovery is actually available. It's just a case of going in there, spending the time and digging it out. I mean, an example of this is when I was on my trip around the Ohio Valley and Pennsylvania, etc., and I visited Ross. I went to Miamisburg Mound, which is a famous, a burial mound. Nearby, there was a giant sarcophagus found. There was 8 and 9 foot giants found in the area. And I found this out because I went into the local historical records office. I got chatting with some people. I couldn't believe that someone from England was even visiting their, historical society. and they just gave me this booklet that someone wrote like 15 or 20, 22 years ago, I think. And it was actually for a strange conference set up even by Monsanto. And they built,
Monsanto?
Yeah, it was really strange. And, and actually it was the, details about why they chose that site for there, because this is where they do a lot of nuclear, messing about with
genetics,
different radioactive things, and a long time ago. And they chose the site next to a mound because they thought it was powerful, and so they did a lot of research was done by them 22 or 23 years ago, and this little booklet was it had all the newspaper reports and early references to the giants that were found there. And it just amazes me that even back then you have, the knowledge of this isn't, is known about, even going back 20 or 30 years. And, if I hadn't gone into this place and asked the right questions, nothing would have ever, they would have just laid dead there for a lot longer, probably. So it's amazing how just a bit of investigative, a mindset that's investigative, actually, you get results. And I think, people like Ross and Jim have been doing this, and this is how things come out of the woodwork. You just forget, the internet's great, TV's great, well, not that great, and, books are great, but it's the individual's research, which, this is how these, revelations come forth. So I encourage people to do that.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think there's so much more to be discovered. It might feel like I don't feel so, but I guess many people out there feels that, there's no mysteries left. Everything is covered, we quote unquote know everything, with the science we have at our disposal. But I think quite the contrary, there's much more left out there. And I think consequent, if there's development of land, et cetera, and as long as it's not covered up, intentionally and everything else, there could be, monumental discoveries in the future as well. So I'm hoping for that at least. Hugh, why don't we just give us the website and the skinny again on the next few events that you have upcoming, Hugh?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, the website's megalithomania.co.uk. And we're doing our annual conference in Glastonbury, England, where I'm currently at right now. We have Ross coming in doing a Skype lecture, Robert Shock, Andrew Collins, Ewan Mackay, who's actually the father, the main guy, who kind of, after Alexander Thom, who popularized archaeoastronomy. He actually coined the term, I think. And he's like a professor from university up in Glasgow, or former professor. And Maria Wheatley, we've got several other speakers. It's going to be pretty interesting, lots of tours. In August, we're going to Ireland. We're doing a tour, kind of. Our tours are like research trips, really. We don't go there. We like to research while we're there, and we do dowsing, and we test for energies with some devices that we've got and things like this. So often, you know, we like to discover things as an opportunity for groups to, you know, to join us and do that. That's in August. And then September, we're heading over to Göbekli Tepe. This is what I'm absolutely fascinated by at the moment. And to Baalbek and to Karahunj in Armenia to check out the major megalithic temple sites there. This is all with Andrew Collins, who's got a book coming out. He's going to be a megalithomania as well. He's got a book coming out called Finding Eden, which is about the latest update on Göbekli Tepe. That's not out till next year, but he's going to be presenting all his latest stuff at the conference. And then we're going to be doing Megalith America or Megalithomania USA in Boston, just south of Boston in Quincy, on the 5th and 6th of October. That's going to be launched in the next couple of weeks. And then we're going to be going to Peru and Bolivia and Nazca. Again, every year we like to do that with Brian Forrester. And I'm going to have a special guest that's going to be announced soon. That's always in November. There's so much to see in South America. There's a lot yet to be discovered down there. And so it's an opportunity for people to kind of really get involved. I mean, the megalithic sites there are remarkable if people haven't seen them before. And some people are saying now they are contemporary possibly with Göbekli Tepe, which is again a 10,000 BC site. The comparisons are being made by Robert Schock, who joined us last year, and David Hatch Childress the year before. So, there's a lot out there. I mean, like you said, there is more out there to be discovered. There's sites that haven't been found yet. I mean, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, it was only found, 15 years ago, 10 years ago?
Sure,
And so, you know, stuff's still out there, and only about 5 or 10% of it's been uncovered so far. So that could be the tip of the iceberg. We just need to dig a little deeper. I mean, literally. So if people want to check all that out, it's just megalithomania.co.uk. I'm Hugh Newman on Facebook and all these other social networks. People can contact me through them as well.
Very good. Thank you for your time, Hugh, as well. And Ross, we'll end with you if you want to mention your book titles again. And of course, you know, if there's anything else you'd like to leave us with here, Ross.
Yeah, my books, you can order them through the Ancient American Bookstore. Just go to ancientamerican.com and go to their bookstore, and the books by Ross Hamilton are there. One thing that I wanted to mention is that, you know, he's right. We have to put our attention into detailing to be able to uncover anything. You have to actually put in the time if you want to, you know, expose the divine, so to speak. There's an old philosophical statement that, you know, where your attention goes, there also goes your love. And so I just want to say that in the future, we have to stop literally digging with shovels unless we really know what we're doing, because there are tombs and there are repositories out there that have intentionally been concealed by men who are far more intelligent than we are today, specifically so that they could be rediscovered at the proper time. These tombs, and one of them I think is Serpent Mound, will have to be reactivated through a new kind of archaeology, an archaeology that lights a sort of lamp, a lamp that begins to restore the internal light so that we can see into the internal world and therefore kind of begin to understand the light that our ancestors had in order to conceal them from us, whom they knew would fall into darkness. So we're headed for a new era where we're going to be literally situating special lamps on specific sites in order to gradually wear away the veils concealing the real truth about the ancient world. So we can do so much through pick and shovel. We can refine our arts and sciences using X-ray technology, echo technology, and so forth. But when it really comes down to it, we're going to have to put in the refinements of spiritual technology to be able to go those extra few yards and really uncover those priceless tombs wherein things are carefully buried that will reunite us with our past. Thank you.
All right. Interesting suggestion. Something to think about indeed. We'll end with that. We'll have the links, of course, to much of this material that we've been talking about up on redicemembers.com and redicecreations.com. So do check that out. Thanks, Ross, Pugh, and thanks to Jim as well for joining us earlier.
Thank you, Henry. It's been great.
Thank you for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back shortly with Ulla Dammegård for the third and last part in our series on the assassination of Olof Palme. We have much more coming after this. You're welcome to tune in again. Thank you, Fredrik, Lana, and Elizabeth. We will speak to you soon. In the meantime, take care and be well.